All in the Industry is sponsored by Pop Menu, which helps turn first-time guests into regulars for your restaurant. For a limited time, get $100 off your first month at popmenu.com/HRN. This episode is brought to you by Diageo Bar Academy. Learn more at DiageoBarAcademy.com. That's Diageo BarAcademy.com. Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It is Wednesday, June 16th, 2021. This is our 292nd episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is an outstanding restaurateur with places in Philadelphia and Manhattan, and I will introduce her fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip. And then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to be supportive of women in the workplace. Yes, we have come a long way over the past decades, but women still face challenges from equal pay to job opportunities and even having a voice. So let's remember to support one another and provide guidance and mentorship, especially to the younger generation. We can not only learn from each other and empower one another, but together break the glass ceiling. That's my tip today. Now I'm thrilled to have my guest joining me. It is Ellen Yin. She is the co-founder and owner of High Street Hospitality Group, which includes some of the country's most celebrated dining establishments, which are A Kitchen Plus Bar, Fork, High Street Philly, and High Street Provisions in Philadelphia, and High Street on Hudson in Manhattan. A graduate of the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, Ellen has over 21 years of experience as an owner and operator. She's been honored with Philadelphia Business Journal's Women of Distinction Award in 2020 and is a multi-year nominee for Outstanding Restaurateur by the James Beard Foundation Awards, among many other accolades. Without further ado, Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sherry. Great to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for joining me. I haven't seen you in a bit. I miss you.
I know. It's crazy to have not seen people in such a long time.
I know. I feel people are starting to go back out and dine more. So I hope to see you soon. And I'm really great we connect today because, you know, I've known you for a while, but I don't know how did you get started in the hospitality industry? Do you want to take us back a little bit to your childhood and kind of what inspired you to want to own restaurants?
I know, it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm just like so many other kids across the country who started out their first job in high school as a teenager in a restaurant. And I think that's an important thing to note, that restaurants are often the first place that people get their jobs. And I was a bus girl in a French restaurant in my hometown in Monmouth County, New Jersey, where I, just fell in love with the industry. And I think part of it came from the fact that at first I was the child of my parents were immigrants from China, and my father was an electrical engineer and my mother was a homemaker, and my father wanted nothing but for me to be a doctor, a lawyer, or engineer. And I was one of those kids who was very independent and buck this system. And I did not want to be, I could have been a physician, I guess. I do love healthcare, but I love arts and started working in a restaurant and just feeling like the environment was so diverse and I love service. What can I say? You know, when my mother would entertain, that would be one of my favorite parts. I would make recipes from Bon Appetit and Gourmet magazine and, you know, make my father eat them. But I just fell in love with working at this restaurant when I was a junior and senior in high school. And that stuck with me throughout my, you know, young adult years. And I came to Philadelphia to go to Penn, and I had many crises where I couldn't decide really what I wanted to do, but it always came down to the restaurant, and I missed it immensely. And so I thought the right thing to do was to take a semester off and work in a restaurant at home. And I did that. And when I came back, I figured out I need to get a job in a restaurant to make my way through college, not just to pay my way through college, because I'm not going to do what my parents want me to do. But also I need to work for my own sanity because I love it so much.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you followed that. And, you know, thinking of my background, same thing. I got a job in a restaurant as soon as I could drive and have a long history of working in restaurants. It was something, I think, when you have that bug for the hospitality industry, it drives you in and you want to be a part of it. So how did you then go about opening? I know you opened Fork in 1997. So what were you doing before that? Were you writing a business plan or
right?
Yeah.
So knowing that I wanted to open a restaurant at some point in the future, I took a class in entrepreneurial management and wrote a business plan about a property in Old City, Philadelphia that we turned into a jazz club on the first floor and condos on the upper floors. And that kind of is the model of so many restaurants in urban environments. But I learned that it was going to take a lot of capital to renovate the entire building. And that stuck with me, that I wasn't going to be able to fulfill my dream that easily. My parents weren't going to give me the money, and I didn't have the money. So I knew that I would have to get a job. And first, I thought working in an advertising agency would be up my alley, because it's a creative, you know, there's a lot of creativity in marketing and advertising. But I ended up going through a number of different jobs in my early 20s, including fundraising and event planning. And I just didn't feel the same satisfaction. So not knowing what to do, I went to grad school. And I got my MBA in healthcare management, because like I said, there was something also about healthcare, taking care of people, I think, that really attracted me about that industry. And I ended up getting a job in a consulting firm. And within 3 months, I knew it wasn't for me. So I worked with a bunch of people kind of on a freelance basis, doing projects here and there. And then I thought, well, I'll take a stab at working in a hospital. Meanwhile, I found out working in a hospital, which I really loved, but it's like working in a big corporation. So I didn't fit in there. And so finally I decided I'm gonna take a shot at it. I was flipping through Food and Wine, I think, and I saw all these 30-something-year-old people opening restaurants. And I'm like, well, why can't that be me? So I started putting together a business plan at that point, taking that plan that I had started in undergrad, and I happened to find a spot that I really loved in Old City, Philadelphia, and kind of the rest is history. We put together a business plan. My classmate from grad school, Roberto Sella, we've been partners for 20 some years, and you know, we decided that we wanted to open a restaurant that was a neighborhood restaurant, a destination, and we were able to get some bank financing for it.
Wow, that's amazing. So, I mean, the fact that Fork has been going strong all these years, I mean, how has the is incredible. And how has the concept changed, or has it changed from the beginning? And you've changed chefs over the years. And I was there, God, when was I there? Like about, now it feels like maybe 8 years ago or something. I don't know. I had a wonderful experience with our good friend Pichet Ong and how we met. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But over the years, like from the beginning to where you are today, how has the concept changed?
Well, I think the heart of what Fork is has remained the same. And there's two things that have remained consistent over the years. One is that my first chef, Anne-Marie Lasher, and I both worked at the White Dog Cafe under Judy Wicks. And the White Dog Cafe was a restaurant in Philadelphia that that really was committed to farm to table as well as social issues and community. And Judy Wicks is an incredible mentor, and you know, that model of being able to take what you believe in and incorporating it into your business was really important to us. Anne-Marie really introduced the concept of buying seasonally and locally and using, you know, great farm products at the very beginning of Fork. And that continued through every chef to today. And we've had five or six chefs throughout the 25 years. So that has continued. And I think our commitment to creating a great community around us is really important. That means the people who are included in the building, our staff, our guests, the immediate kind of, neighborhood, which is Old City. We've always remained really committed to making sure that all three of those things are vibrant and healthy.
Yeah. So when did you, I guess, when did you get the bug or the idea that you should open another place and more restaurants and add that to your plate?
Well, you know, like any entrepreneur, you can't stop yourself. I think that at the very beginning, Anne-Marie and I had never expected the response from the media that Fork received from the very beginning. And, you know, we ended up splitting up as partners because I wanted to grow, and I think she really wanted to have, you know, a cozy neighborhood place. And as we got busier, I saw more opportunity, and I wanted it to continue. And of course, people were coming up to me and asking me if I wanted to open a place here and open a place there, just like they still are. But I wasn't really able to successfully execute that until 2004. So that was about 7 years in. We really started out as a small business where we were owner operated, and she, Anne-Marie, was the working chef and I was the working general manager. And, you know, it took some time for us to be able to build the management structure and to get that really going so that we could expand. And Anne-Marie ended up opening her own business in 2000 or 2001. And at that point, we had moved on to a new chef. And by 2004, we were planning to take over another restaurant on the other side of town. And we were also expanding our own physical plant to include a private dining room and this little bakery gourmet store called Fork Etc., which was the predecessor to High Street.
Yeah, I saw that. I was reading more about your background because I was only familiar before with High Street and that you brought that concept also to New York City. But tell for people who don't know, like how is High Street also what's the concept there and compared to what you're doing in Philly now to Manhattan? Because I think you've changed it up a little bit.
Right. So, you know, when we, so many things have happened.
Right. I know.
It's really
condensed into like a little 45 minute podcast, but let's.
Right. Yeah. And when you're talking about 25 years, there's so many things have influenced each other. Right. But we opened High Street on Hudson 6 years ago in the West Village on Hudson and Horatio Street. An amazing neighborhood. I love the location. It's a cobblestone street just south of the Meatpacking District. And, you know, we started out there planning it in 2014. And as you know, my business partner, Eli Culp, who was the chef, was planning to be the chef of High Street on Hudson. And then he was on the Amtrak accident, and all that was happening as we were opening High Street on Hudson. By the time we opened in December, which, you know, in restaurant development terms, that was fairly quick, I guess. But by the time we opened in December 2015, you know, it was Eli's role was already starting to become evident that he wasn't going to be able to actually be the chef behind the kitchen cooking the food for the guests. And so at that time, we had planned for a transition to New York, including a New York-based team and including our Philadelphia original High Street Hospitality Group folks like Alex Bois, who went on to open Lost Bread, and John Knobler and Sam Kincaid, who later opened up Cadence. They all came with us to help Eli and I open High Street on Hudson. And, you know, High Street on Hudson started out as an all-day concept, just like High Street on Market, with a great breakfast and sandwich program. Maybe we didn't understand the New York market as well as we should have, where everybody who walked by was asking us, when are we opening for dinner? And we're like, oh, we're opening for lunch first. So we opened first for breakfast and lunch with our sandwich program. And then we eventually opened for dinner in mid-February. And, you know, there was a lot of excitement around our opening.
Yeah, there was. I remember the excitement about it, and I'm a huge fan. I was so glad that you opened in New York City, even though Philly isn't that far from here. But I know with the chef, Chef Eli Culp, his accident, it was very, you know, a tragic accident that happened, and I'm sure it changed so many things with the company and with your role. And what's his involvement now? I have to say, I've been listening to his podcast, the Chef Radio podcast, and it's awesome. I think he's really good. So I'm glad that he's now doing that.
Yeah, Eli is an extremely talented and resilient person. And, you know, I'm sure that you've heard some of the story, the first podcast where he describes the feeling that he had at depression and, you know, of this life-changing event, which really screwed things up, you know, for him, because he was on the top of his game at that time. I mean, you know, he had been Food and Wine Best New Chef. He had been nominated for Best Chef Mid-Atlantic. And he was achieving his dream, which was to open a restaurant in New York City, and then everything changed. So, you know, at the very beginning, I think that we all rallied as much as possible to try to get things done and so that Eli could come back and, you know, really, you know, kind of just jump back right into it. I think that most people don't know what the prognosis or the challenges of a spinal cord injury is. There are many people who can get better and many people who can't get better, and it's so much is unknown, you know. And so we just kept hoping that Eli would get better, and I'm sure he did too. And you know, I think that that his As he started to maybe accept his situation and adapt to his situation more, he became stronger and stronger mentally, and, you know, you know, he just is, he's an incredible person to work with. And we continue to work on projects together, and he's not as involved with the day-to-day operations, but he has a, you know, a son that he adores, and he's very busy raising. And and, you know, like I said, we're still very involved with the businesses that we operate.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I'm glad he's gotten to where he is now, and your relationship that you continue to work together, because, and you, and how you've pulled through that time period, and even, and now, I mean, we should talk a little bit about this past year with the pandemic. How was it for you? How's it going? You know, I think you're starting to get to the, maybe a bit of the light at the end of this tunnel we've been in.
Well, you know me, I'm always very honest. And I will say that last March was very gloomy, that I really thought that, one, first of all, having to lay off so many people, I just never imagined in my mind that a pandemic was going to take my business down. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
And I really thought that it was only going to be a few weeks. And my PR agency, Foxglove, Giovecchio, said to me, why don't you go on this IRC, Independent Restaurant Coalition, call? Because they're all talking about the same thing you are, and maybe that will shed some light. And so I took her advice, and I joined the calls, and I started to have hope, because I heard people who, you know, in the industry who I revere, basically feeling the exact same thing that I did and wondering what they're going to do. And over the course of the next few weeks, relief started to become evident that there was going to be forms of relief available. And that started to build momentum. At the same time, we raised some money, and we were able to do some frontline worker meals for Fork. And, you know, we had to unfortunately keep High Street on Hudson closed because so many of our staff returned to their, you know, their original homes, many of them outside of New York City. But also there was a travel quarantine for Pennsylvanians to quarantine for 14 days. So I did not go to New York from, I would say, March 8th or something like that until, I want to say sometime that summer, I did not visit New York City, which is weird.
Yeah. But what the, you know, I mean, it's weird, but it's like, it is what it was required, you know?
Right, so, right. But it's like you lock up your house, or, you know, and you haven't been there in such a long time that it's so strange when you actually re-enter it, you know?
Right. So, and then I saw you partnered with, or collaborated with Brunetti Pizza.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it became evident that there was so much to do and to rebuild, and that because we had to part ways with so many of our team members, that we were going to have to rebuild. And also, it was really hard to find people, even in the middle of the pandemic. You know, when we reopened for outside, not everybody was in a hurry to jump back in and start waiting on people. So, I knew that I wasn't going to have the time to really focus on New York. And I have to be honest, I didn't know whether we could even reopen or succeed in New York City. And my landlord actually, you know, we were really fortunate. Our landlord said to us, listen, this is not my first time where something in New York City, that the economy has not been at its best, and I powered through it, and I think you guys should too. And he said to us, listen, I'll work with you. And we were very lucky, because that's not the answer that a lot of people received. So knowing that he was committed to helping us, and knowing that you know, we wanted to see it to the other side, we reopened it in late August, but I knew that I could not do it myself. And quite honestly, I knew that we couldn't open the bakery again because even though baked goods were one of the top items that, that people wanted during the pandemic, the cost of operating it and the, you know, potential for it to not be able to cover itself in a time when we had to at least cover ourselves wasn't going to work. So I thought to myself, who can I partner with to help us through this situation? And I had been friendly with James Shields from Brunetti Pizza and knew him as an operator. And I knew that he was from New York City and knew the neighborhood really well. And so I asked him, I said, hey, would you have any interest in helping us, you know, do a pop-up or something here just to keep us alive? And he said he definitely was interested. And so the three of us met, Eli, myself, and James, to try to brainstorm what could be done. And he really felt that the neighborhood needed a seafood restaurant and a place where they could have drinks. And so that's what we decided that we would do from August until, you know, until we figured out what was going to happen. So we're still figuring out what's going to happen.
Yeah, I give you a lot of credit. It's so much, and we're just now. Multiple restaurants that all dealing with and getting through this time. But I'm glad you were able to figure out that partnership and collaborate. I mean, I think there has been great things that have come from this time period, and with the IRC and everything, you know, that, you know, uniting with people who have the same issues and can relate. So I'm glad that Gia got you on that call. I let me ask you my question from my last guest on episode 291. I had on Fanny Gerson. She's the chef and founder of La New Yorkina and Fan Fan Donuts in New York City. And she wants to know, what's the one thing that has surprised you during the pandemic about yourself that has helped or changed you in any way with what we do?
Well, I think that that we all have a certain degree of resiliency inside ourselves, and I really, really pushed to make myself come through it, because it's so easy to have said, oh, we're not going to reopen, I'm just going to move on or whatever. You know, I think that resiliency is something that I never thought about myself. You know, the more I thought about it, the more things I was able to do. And that's the crazy part, is at first I was so overwhelmed by like everything. And then I ended up doing more things than I even ever expected that I would be able to fit into my schedule, which is just crazy because there's so many things going on. But we ended up creating a pop-up at Fork called the Wonton Project. I don't know if I told you about that or not, but
I found it online a little bit about it. But yeah, tell us about it.
So, you know, we were trying to, Fork has been the most challenging of all our operations. A Kitchen is kind of in the middle of downtown, and there are a lot of young people who live there, and people are out and about despite, you know, whatever restrictions there were. And Fork is in the tourist district, and it relies a lot on business travelers and, you know, celebrations and private events and things like that. So, you know, I knew that that was going to be the toughest one. And this is something that was also different for me, was, you know, I'm a Asian woman who operates a contemporary American restaurant. And, you know, I never really thought about my own heritage taking any role in what I do. And, you know, maybe that's just because I've grown up at a time period when belonging was so important. You know, when I was a child, we were the only Asian family in my hometown. And, you know, I always thought about wanting to kind of integrate, you know what I mean? And so when we were trying to figure out what to do with Fork, I always thought that my mother's cooking was amazing. And I was thinking to myself, you know, maybe I should do something with my mother's home cooking. And then I called Stephen Starr up one day and I said, hey, I'm just seeing how you are and what you're up to. And he was bummed out too. And he said, have you ever thought about going out to the suburbs? And I was like, not really. And he's just like, well, what about opening an Asian restaurant? You would kill it, you know? And I thought to myself, huh, maybe that idea of my mother's cooking is ripe right now. It seems like a lot of the takeout food is ethnically oriented and, you know, maybe this is something that we could do. And Sherry, I don't cook. I don't know if you know that about me, but
now I know.
I actually never cook except for to heat up stuff for my mother. And I love to cook. I mean, it's not that I don't know how to cook, but I just never cook. And so there's nothing in her repertoire that I really know how to make except dumplings and wontons. And my brother learned everything, and all I got was that, because we would sit around the table as a kid and we would make wontons and dumplings. So I was just like, huh, well, dumplings I've seen, but wontons I have not. So maybe we should create a pop-up ghost kitchen around wontons. And so I worked with our chef, George Madowski, at Fork to recreate my mother's recipe. And we did so much R&D and we were ready to go. We had everything going. And then, you know, we reopened and nothing happened. And so then March rolls around and, you know, there was the all the violence in Atlanta and, you know, the lot of publicity around Asian discrimination. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe this is the time when we should be focusing on letting people know that this is a thing. And so I decided that I would open it as a fundraiser for anti-Asian discrimination and hate awareness. And we donated all the proceeds to Advancing Justice and Asian Americans United. And, you know, now it's starting to have a life of its own, but that received a lot of attention and people seem to be really into it. Of course, the hot days of summer, 90 degrees, are not when you really want to eat wontons, but hopefully it'll, you know, we can get our act together and gain some traction and, you know, continue to support that mission, but, you know, create a life for the Wonton Project.
Wow. You're amazing. That's awesome. I would like to eat your wontons all year. there's no season for that for me. So, yeah, good for you. That's really, really, really awesome. I don't know how you do everything you do, but somehow you do. So on that note, let's take a little break. We'll come back. We'll play my speedrun game. We'll talk some industry news. I have my solo dining experience. And then the final question. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Bartenders wanted. Diageo Bar Academy is willing to train. Each week in June, Diageo Bar Academy hosts new master classes that you need to succeed this summer. Sign up today at DiageoBarAcademy.com. Under training, click on master classes. You'll find a large format cocktail series, including draft cocktails, frozen, pre-batched, and group serves, as well as a summer served up series with cocktails plus popsicles, and all the ways that you can make your menu pop during the hotter months. To see all events and RSVP for one of the many can't miss master classes, go to DiageoBarAcademy.com. Diageo Bar Academy offers free training and resources for you and every member of your team. Whether you are a bartender, barback, or manager, or completely new to the industry, Diageo Bar Academy has easy-to-access resources to help you learn new skills or stay in the loop with all the latest industry trends. Stay informed, inspired, and connected to grow your career or business by joining Diageo Bar Academy today. Why wait? Visit DiageoBarAcademy.com. That's D-I-A-G-E-O BarAcademy.com. Become a member and sign up for the newsletter today. It's completely free, and you will be amazed at all they have to offer. That's D-I-A-G-E-O BarAcademy.com. Restaurants across the country are reopening, and as an owner, it's more important than ever to focus on your guest experience. That's why I recommend Pop Menu, which gives restaurant owners the marketing tools to turn new guests into happy regulars. Pop Menu transforms your restaurant's online presence with dynamic, user-friendly menu technology on your website, including real-time menu updates. And Pop Menu is more than just an online menu. It's an all-in-one set of digital tools that help strengthen the relationship between you and your customer, enabling you to cater your website to your guests, whether they want to order online and get delivery, or venture out for safe in-person dining with contactless menus. And with Pop Menu's remarketing tools, you can stop letting third-party platforms steal the relationship with your guests and stay top of mind. If you're a restaurant owner, start using Pop Menu today. For a limited time, my listeners can get $100 off your first month, plus lock in one unchanging monthly rate at popmenu.com/HRN. Go now to get your $100 off your first month at popmenu.com/HRN.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Ellen Yin. She's the co-founder and owner of High Street Hospitality Group, which includes A Kitchen Plus Bar, Fork, High Street Philly, High Street Provisions, and those are all in Philadelphia, and she has High Street on Hudson in Manhattan. So Ellen, it's time for my speed round game. What this is I'm going to name a couple things and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla.
Okay.
All right, here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat out.
I figured you'd say that. Wine, beer, cocktail, mocktail, or champagne?
Wine.
Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
Small plates.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Chef's counter.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Well, that's a tough one, so that can't be a short answer, but I'm going to say tipping.
Okay. I know that one usually stumps people a little bit. Okay, how about Pat's or Geno's? Going local.
I don't eat cheesesteaks, but...
I did a taste test once when I was there. I don't really eat them that much either, but for me, like, it's one of those, when you're in Philly, that touristy thing to do.
Well, the true sandwich is really the roast pork, but that can be a whole other discussion.
Yes. Okay. We'll save that for another time. Okay. How about dining with Pichet or eating his desserts?
Dining with Pichet. Sorry. I love his desserts, but he's such a character.
He is a character. Probably dining with Pichet and having his desserts, right?
That's a bonus, right?
Okay, two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
I do love both, but I'm going to say dessert.
All right. Manhattan, Brooklyn, or Philadelphia?
Oh, come on.
Sorry.
I can't answer that one on Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, some rules. You can skip it. Yeah. I can't choose. It's like choosing between children. Is that?
It is. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Exactly.
All right. No problem. Well, that's the game. You were very speedy up until when skipping the final one.
That's a tough question because people do ask me that all the time. And I do really love our location in Manhattan. And I do also love Brooklyn. But you know, I have lived in Philadelphia since I was 18 years old. So I really can't say that I don't love Philadelphia first. But you know, New York would be my equal.
Yeah. Well, I hear you. Okay, for industry news, two articles. First is on Bloomberg, we ate 11 Madison Park's $335 vegan menu, and here is what it's like. What you can expect if you're one of the 15,000 people on the wait list, and this was by Kate Crater. I can't believe they have a wait list of 15,000 people, but...
Well, clearly they are delivering what customers want.
Yeah,
well, at least for the first 15,000.
Yeah, this has been big news. You know, 11 Madison Park reopened on June 10th, and they went all vegan, which is a change for the restaurant. This is chef and owner Daniel Hume's place. It's pricey. It's very pricey, but apparently they have the clientele. I mean, what's your take on going all vegan? Is it something you would do?
Well, I'm not vegan, but I do see why people would be attracted to that. Plant-based food diets are extremely in right now. And, you know, I do think it's something that people can't do at home. You know, 11 Madison Park is so much about the entire experience. Mm-hmm. It's the room. It's the service. It's the entire experience. So I'm not sure whether or not it matters whether it's vegan or not, but for me at least, you know, I just take it all in. And for me, and maybe that's why I'm a restaurateur, not a chef, that I feel that it's about the experience that you're getting, not necessarily about 100% about what you're eating. That's just icing on the cake for me.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And that, yes, it is. So much about the experience and the times I've been there. It's been incredible. I'm looking at this, they have the full menu. They were saying with two people without drinks would cost $730. There's also a six course menu for $175. That's at the bar, which, I think, you know, sounds like, something I may try to do first if I could get in, but the food looks beautiful. I have to say, right. Anyone who wants to see what's get a little peek of what's happening there, go to this Bloomberg article because it's like stunning.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's part of the experience, mm-hmm. And you know, to be quite honest, you know, I think that to do something like that really takes a lot of guts to pull a complete change. But also I think it makes a point about the what it takes to operate a restaurant these days. You know, I mean, it's not just the cost of the vegetables. It's the intellectual property of, you know, this creative team who put in a ton of time and effort to create this beautiful experience. It's a piece of artwork, you know. It's not really about what you necessarily crave or whatever, but it is stunningly gorgeous and something that people will definitely have never experienced before.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that in alignment with the fact that labor, the cost of labor is going to be increasing if we want to create a more equitable and fair environment for people. You know, hopefully some of that $700 is going to cover their amazing staff.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's way more than just the food on the plate. It's the experience. I think this meal, from what I've seen, is it's 4 or 5 hours. It's your night out. It's theater. It's entertainment. It's very special. I mean, very special. Right, not like an understatement.
Not everybody is going to want it, but I mean, mm-hmm. I think that people who appreciate dining, certainly mm-hmm. it's an experience that I definitely want to try, even though I'm not a tasting menu type person.
Yeah. And as I said, I would do the bar first, but I mean, if I would like, I would love to do the whole experience, but you know, we'll see in time if, and also how he changes the menu, you know, over.
Right. Well, once, I mean, like after 15,000 people, I don't know, it might be next June before I can get in.
We'll see. But good for them. It looks fantastic. So, anyone, yeah, who can get in, go and enjoy. The other article I had was on Eater New York, and it's just about the what's happened today, that the article is, or yesterday, that it's entitled mm-hmm. New York lifts restaurant restrictions as adult COVID-19 vaccination rates surpass 70%. Restaurants and bars no longer have to abide to social distancing regulations, according to the state. This was by Erica Adams. So apparently in California, I think it's so interesting that California and New York at the exact same time lifted these restrictions, because both have over 70% of the population at least partially vaccinated. So,
it's incredible news.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting. Mm-hmm. I think people are excited to be out and kind of feeling things getting back to more normal, or whatever the new normal is. But what's happening in Philly with restrictions?
Well, Philadelphia has been a little bit more conservative, but Philadelphia, 70% of adults are partially vaccinated, and I think 54% of Philadelphia residents are fully vaccinated as of Monday, is what I heard. I have to give the healthcare workers in Philadelphia a ton of credit, because, you know, you would think that it's easy to hit that number, but they actually have been going almost door to door. They have a $50,000 sweepstakes to try to close the gap on the 70%. So they're being really creative about trying to get as many people vaccinated. And the challenging part is, you know, the pockets of areas in you know, any urban environment where, you know, maybe people can't get to, they had a mass vaccination center in downtown Philadelphia. Well, if you can't get there because you have to take a bus and the subway and then walk, you know, it's a disincentive sometimes. And even though, you know, for some of us that wouldn't make a difference, we would just go. I mean, I drove to New Jersey to get vaccinated,
we went to City Field.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. I was lucky enough to be vaccinated early because my mother's compromised. And so I was able to get it early. So that's why I left the city. But, yeah. I think that, Philadelphia, we don't have restrictions as well. And the problem isn't really the restrictions anymore. The problem is whether or not you have enough staff to cover the amount of,
right,
you know, tables and chairs and business that you have. And that is going to be the biggest challenge. People said that, you could increase your occupancy from 50 to 75%. Actually, we haven't been able to get past 75% because we're still trying to hire people in the kitchen, back of the house, front of the house.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a challenge.
I know. I know my clients are all saying that, everyone's saying that it's everywhere. And I wish I had a solution. You know, I feel we need to get more staff in all areas.
I mean, I think that, there's so many factors related to that, but, we've been lucky enough to have some young people be part of our team. And, typically, I don't have that many college students, but right now I have like 3 or 4 college students that we are developing. I just feel like hospitality is one of those industries that it prepares you for anything in life. You know what I mean? it's never going to hurt you. And, you know, your ability to deal with people, to be able to multitask, to be able to handle pressure. I mean, all those things are really, really important. And it's heartbreaking that it's so hard to find people. But, you know, I also feel like, you know, our industry in March, all the frailties of the restaurant industry were revealed. And then a third of the people who were already out the door, and there's always a third of the people who have their foot out the door to either become an artist, to become an actor, to get your real estate license, to, you know, have a baby, whatever, you know, just like customers, you always have a percentage who are moving or whatever. And then you have a third of the people who love working like me and who we didn't ever stop. And then you have a third of the people who maybe for whatever reason, they don't feel comfortable yet. And I have to say that sometimes I walk into a room where there's a ton of people and I even feel uncomfortable a little bit, but I know that I've been vaccinated, but still there's this just kind of disconnect between how quickly there's no masks required and, you know, and how many people are in the space, because you don't know whether everybody's been vaccinated or not. But anyway, I'm excited. I can't wait to, you know, yesterday we took our team out to a winery and, you know, everybody was mask free and, you know, we felt really comfortable and it just felt nice to be out and about. But going back to the labor situation, you know, I think that rebuilding that that third from people who may not have been considered previously as candidates for our industry is really important. And that not only includes, you know, people who have left other industries, younger people who are in high school and college still, and, you know, may not even know to consider hospitality as an option. You know, people re-entering the workforce from, you know, prison or whatever, you know.
Yeah, all great points. And I've always thought that everyone should work in a restaurant at some point in their life. I just think you just to get the experience, and as you said, you learn so much, different skills, and yeah, it's good to be in a service position. So, all right, it's time for my solo dining experience. So this week it's at La Natural. Here's the rundown. The location: 7289 Northwest 2nd Avenue, Little River, Miami, Florida. The concept is a neighborhood restaurant serving sourdough pizza, vegetables, and natural wines in a relaxed indoor and outdoor space. The owner is Javier Ramirez and his wife, Adriana Matos. Why'd I go? Well, I heard wonderful things about this place. I had met Javier at the Philly Chef Conference back in 2020, right before the pandemic.
Right.
So I had a little connection with him, and this was his new place that he got open during the pandemic. So, and I was down for a South Beach Wine and Food Festival, so I decided to go. My experience, I made a reservation on Talk, one of our wonderful sponsors of this show, and my reservation was a late-ish. I arrived from the beach, but I left South Beach to go to this restaurant, which is in a kind of up-and-coming neighborhood in Miami. I was warmly greeted. The place was busy. It had a good vibe. My server was lovely. I ordered. I saw Javier there and his wife, and it was really nice. I had a good time. What did I get? So I got smoked oyster mushrooms with salsa verde as a starter, and then I got the tomato burrata and basil pizza. And their pizza is naturally leavened. It says 48-hour cold ferment. And they also offered me a little coffee at the end. My take. So I loved it. The mushrooms were delicious. They have a lot of great veggies on there. It was kind of hard to choose which one to get. But being solo, that is, I guess, the drawback of it is I can't get as many things as I want to get because I can only eat so much. So my pizza was fabulous. I didn't finish quite the whole thing, but I loved it. You know, warm burrata on top. It had a really nice dough and crust. It was great. The ambiance, it's a warm and inviting casual space with low light and has a front patio. I'd say it's perfect for pizza or veggie lovers. Interesting tidbit, Javier also owns Palmar Restaurant in Miami, and he was a previous partner with Bashore. Personal fun fact, When I was speaking with Javier, he told me that the vegetable plates were actually recipes from a chef whose name is Diego Moya of Racine's in New York City. And I know Diego and I've been to his restaurant. He's a wonderful chef. So I get why. I mean, it was a great call, I think, for them to have him do the veggie plates. So the cost of this meal was $40. That's not including tax, but it is including gratuity. On the menu, it says the prices allow them to compensate for the staff. It also had a little nice note there saying the best way to express gratitude is to become a regular guest. So I really like that. Would I go back? Yes. Mom and Dad down in Miami, put this on your radar. Send you there. Maybe I'll go with you next time I'm down. Website is lanaturalmiami.com and their Instagram is at lanaturalmiami. There we go.
That sounds great.
It was great. Yeah.
I'll have to go there if I go to Florida.
Yeah, Miami. It's as I said, like kind of off. It's a little north of where the design district is. It's Miami is interesting because different neighborhoods keep developing restaurants and turning into these like neighborhood restaurant communities. From when I grew up, these areas weren't destinations. So,
got it.
Yeah,
I didn't know you were from Miami.
I am from Miami. Yeah, it's my hometown, which is why I usually go down to South Beach Food and Wine Festival because it's like it makes sense: family, work, beach.
Sounds great.
yeah, it's a good combo. Okay, so it's time for the final question. My next guest is Josh Sharkey. He's the founder and CEO of Meez, which is M-E-E-Z, and it's the recipe tool for professional chefs. So Ellen, what would you like to ask Josh?
Well, I would love to know how he got buy-in from his first chef, because I see that being an incredible tool. But there are a lot of chefs in small restaurants. We do Recipe Now, but in not all of our places do we have a formal recipe program. And a lot of times chefs say that they don't have enough time to do it. But meanwhile, the most important thing as a chef is to create consistency and be able to replicate whatever recipe that you're making over and over and over again. And so I would love to know what kind of pushback he got and how he overcame that.
Mm, great question. I will find out. And thank you so much. I wish we had more time to talk. We didn't get to so many things that about your restaurant group that I would have loved to dive into. But I'm glad we touched. We covered quite enough, I guess, or got through some of it. But I'm so impressed with you, and I have to say also my tip today with supporting women in the workplace. I was thinking of you. I know you do a lot with organizations and supporting women and mentorship, and it's very credible.
Well, it's really important, as you said. And actually today I just was involved with a panel with Hot Bread Kitchen, and it's just so inspiring what they're doing in terms of workforce development, but also support for women who maybe just need that emotional and mental support in addition to learning how to build their own business.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful, and yeah, you're very involved, and it's I don't know how you do everything you do, but somehow you're doing it, and I wish you much continued success. And I hope things get easier this year, and to see.
Yeah, I can't wait for a vacation.
yeah, you deserve one. So
thank you, Sherry. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. My guest today has been Ellen Yin. She's the co-founder and owner of High Street Hospitality Group, which includes A Kitchen Plus Bar, Fork, High Street Philly, and High Street Provisions in Philadelphia, and High Street on Hudson in Manhattan. Her website is highstreethospitality.com, and that's H-I-G-H-S-T hospitality.com. Follow her. All of her accounts are on social media. There's High ST NYC, High ST Philly, at Fork Street, at Fork Restaurant, and, well, most important, the real Ellen Yin. Follow her there. Follow me at Sherry Bayer, at Bayer PR, and at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites are BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com, and AllInTheIndustry.com. All of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, so you can find us anywhere you can find podcasts. Thanks to my engineer today, Amanda Wang. Thanks again to Ellen and to her fabulous publicists, Gia and Bailey. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'll be back next week with a new show. Hope you'll tune in then. Stay safe and well, and thanks for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.